From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 8th, 2015, when a state board of education voted to appoint a new superintendent to lead a struggling municipal school district. This could very well be the story of schools in many American cities, could be Rochester, but in this case, we're specifically talking about Newark, New Jersey. The new leader was Chris Cerf. He had previously served as the state commissioner of education, appointed by Governor Chris Christie, and back in 2006, he was appointed deputy chancellor of New York City schools. In other words, he knows big education challenges, and he's worked with districts in which there is a great deal of poverty. The Newark Star-Ledger wrote in 2018 that Cerf closed the worst schools, fired the worst principals, and found a way to pay the best teachers more money. Graduation rates went up, and Newark Mayor Raz Baraka worked with Cerf to improve what had been a broken relationship between city and state leaders. Now, that all sounds easy. Great. Do that everywhere. There are plenty of critics, though, of state intervention, of course. And those critics worry that outsiders won't understand local problems or won't get the nuances of individual challenges. Perhaps individuals with too much power are not accountable or won't compromise. And Rochester is facing the same kinds of debates. Who's really in charge? Who should be granted more control, if anyone? Today, the Rochester Beacon is hosting a pair of panel discussions on the proverbial elephant in the room, the challenge of improving Rochester schools. Mayor Lovely Warren will participate, as will Rochester Teachers Association Chief Adam Urbanski. And Chris Cerf will be here to share perspective as well. This hour, we wanted to explore the kinds of experiences from other cities and states that have, well, people who've tried to tackle these kinds of problems that Rochester faces. It is not always apples to apples, but we think there is something instructive about hearing about these experiences from elsewhere. So Kent Gardner has helped put together this conversation and, of course, the event with the Rochester Beacon. He is the opinion editor for the Beacon and, of course, an economist here in Rochester. Great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate being here.
And Chris Cerf is the former commissioner of education for the state of New Jersey, former deputy chancellor of New York City Public Schools. Is that enough for now? What else would you like me to list?
Oh, that's plenty. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we appreciate having you. On the line with us is Marty Walls, who's a Rochester native and an attorney with experience in school receivership programming in Massachusetts. Marty, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I am great. Great to be with you.
Well, Kent, I want to say from the outset here that you have an event this afternoon in which you are overbooked, unfortunately.
So, we are indeed, yes.
So this is not one of those cases where you're advertising, come on down. You're going to be jammed, and you've got a lot of people involved with trying to tackle these very significant challenges. And I want to stress with Chris, with Marty, this hour, we're going to hear about what's happening in Massachusetts. We're going to hear about what happened in New Jersey, for example. And we know that there are people here in Rochester who would oppose such kind of planning or such kind of work here, whether it's mayoral control, state intervention, et cetera. We have talked about that on this program in the past. We'll do that in the future. I think this is just a chance to hear the perspective of people who have done this elsewhere, and our listeners can decide what has kind of, you know, what their views are from those perspectives. What's your goal with what the Beacon is doing this afternoon?
Well, Evan, I think that the many of us in the community who've been watching education issues for a long time and have been struggling with the challenge that the city school district presents have concluded that perhaps the solving this problem is beyond us as a local community, that perhaps we need the state to do something different to disrupt the pattern of ownership and the network of control around this school district. So that's why, you know, we thought for the first half of our panel, this forum this afternoon, that we would focus on alternatives that would require some kind of state intervention.
Well, and I'm already looking at the clock going, how are we going to squeeze in? Just with our two guests, apart from Kent, their experience alone could fill the day of discussion and what they have done. But I'll start with Chris and kind of go back to 2015. Why don't you lay out as best you can for our listeners what your role was and what the landscape was like in Newark as you approached those problems?
Thanks. I'd be happy to. Well, I started my work in Newark even earlier.
Yeah, sure.
I worked very closely with now Senator Cory Booker, who, of course, became mayor of Newark for two terms. And he was very, very committed to what I think ought to be the center of our focus here, which is to make sure that every child, regardless of his or her birth circumstances, has an equal opportunity at life. And his commitment was to make sure that whatever else we also thought were values of equal importance, that we not lose sight of that central objective. And I start with that because it's very, very, very important, because there are any number of competing interests, many of which are entirely legitimate and important, but they don't perfectly intersect with doing everything we can to improve the life opportunities of children. So the Newark School District had been taken over by the state in 1995. And if you read the original documents that led to that takeover, it was a pretty horrific situation where there was corruption, there was a complete absence of educational focus, and you saw graduation rates, you know, in the low 50s, and frankly, not much happening by any objective measure. In 2010, a very interesting partnership was formed between Cory Booker, then the Democratic mayor, and Chris Christie, then the Republican governor of the state of New Jersey. And essentially they said, we are going to do everything in our power to change this. It was a sort of odd bedfellows kind of arrangement. I had worked with Cory for years, but when I became commissioner of education, I inherited, in a sense, line authority over Newark. I also have to say from the outset, I absolutely was committed to restoration of local control and deeply believe in the value of democratic control of a school district. It's a question of how it's done, when it's done, and what's the first priority. So for the next several years, we worked together. There was an elected school board. However, they did not have the final say on very important matters. We did a significant number of things. And I will say that our graduation rate went from, when I became superintendent, went from about 57% to almost 80%. We became the highest performing city in advances in reading and math compared to any other district that had comparable data, the highest college matriculation rate. So we saw a lot of progress. At the same time, there's an awful lot of distance to travel.
All right. So that's a look at the most recent experience that Chris faced in Newark. And in a moment, we're going to talk about what that process is like specifically, how much you were working with the mayor, how much work you did with the school board, because as you say, when they don't have final say, you know, in Rochester alone, we've seen debates about who should have final say and how long the situation has been one way and whether one person should get more power. We'll come back to that. I want to talk to Marty about some of the work that Marty has done in the state of Massachusetts, because Marty recently wrote an essay for the Democrat and Chronicle describing not only your views on what maybe Rochester can learn, but also some of your roots here. You said your mother worked as a Rochester City School District librarian. Is that right?
That is right. I grew up watching her go to work every morning, and Adam Urbanski was her union president. So some of the people are still the same all these years later.
Who will be there today. Is that right, Kent Gardner?
That's correct.
He'll be one of the ones there today. And so now Marty lives and works in Boston. And so you've worked as a member of the Massachusetts State Legislature. You were co-chair of the Education Committee and the lead author of legislation that allows the state to put struggling school districts into receivership. Marty, I think a lot of people hear the word receivership and they either vaguely have an idea or they have this idea that the state comes in and no one locally is in control anymore and has any say. There's probably a lot of different flavors of this. And why don't you kind of give us a sense for what you have put together or at least helped put together in Massachusetts and why you think it works?
Lawrence, Massachusetts is a great example of what's possible. What Chris was just describing for Newark is very similar to what was going on in Lawrence and obviously is similar to what's going on in Rochester. In fact, the New York State law that has been used in connection with East High School and some of the other schools in Rochester is based on the law that we did in Massachusetts. The law in Massachusetts went a little further, though, with regard to districts, and that's where I think there's an instructive example here. Receivership is a big, scary word, so what's more important than the word, which has different meanings in different places, is what it allows, kind of what's the flavor, what happens. And in this instance, in receivership, the state appoints an individual to be the receiver of a school district. So it's somebody from outside the district, but it's not necessarily a total stranger. In the case of Lawrence, it was an educator who had spent many, many years in urban education, including in Boston, so was deeply familiar with the challenges of low-performing districts, including deep segregation and deep poverty, some of the challenges that, of course, face Rochester as well. And so to answer the question of who has the final say, one of the questions you posed, under Massachusetts law, it is the receiver. And the receiver has extraordinary power, which, if he or she chooses to use it, can be incredibly effective. But the danger is that once the receiver leaves, a community goes back to the old way of doing things. So the most effective way to be a receiver is to embed the changes in the community so that the community itself takes ownership of the schools, is part of the process. It's things are done with community members, not to them. And it is that kind of collaboration and partnership that can drive the kind of change in a community that's longer lasting and isn't reliant on one person. So the receiver in Lawrence stayed for several years, just left last year, and now there is a superintendent and a board as the governing model in receivership. So slowly things are being returned to the community, but in a way where parents and other stakeholders are beginning to take responsibility for the schools and the change, and they don't want to go back to the old way even when they get full power back. There are many ways to do this. I think that's just an important message for folks in Rochester to understand. It's not a one-size-fits-all. A lot of lessons to be learned in other cities, but there can be a solution that's tailored to Rochester's needs, but someone needs to step in and literally take responsibility to collaborate and create a new way of thinking about educating kids.
So let me ask both Marty and Chris about two of the common complaints about this kind of a process. And Marty, I'll start with you. When you point out that the receiver has extraordinary power, one of the complaints is that it is anti-democratic, that if we want to improve a local situation, whether it's schools or anything else, take the school board. You can elect school board members. If you don't like the job they are doing, elections have consequences. You can elect different people. You can elect people who will choose to do things that a receiver might do. But putting the power in the hands of one person, even if it's a receiver who does have at least some experience in a district, if it's not just an outsider coming in, but even if that's the case, you put the power in one person's hands. They're not elected by members of a local community. They don't face that sort of electoral consequence, and that there may not be accountability there. That sounds anti-democratic to some. What do you say to that, Marty?
In Massachusetts, it is the governor who would have ultimate responsibility when a district goes into state receivership. So there is accountability in the political system. So point one, this is not somebody who just swoops in having powers bestowed upon him or her. There is an elected official who is fully responsible. But the other point I think is incredibly important to make is that at some point radical change is needed when for generations we have been sacrificing children, when adults can't get it together to elect the people who will do the work necessary to improve the schools. It is a big step, and it should never be one that's taken lightly. I don't disagree with that. But at some point, when do we step in and say it is our moral responsibility to the children of Rochester or whatever city that we are going to do this, even though it divests an elected school board of responsibility, it keeps an elected official responsible, and that is, in the case in Massachusetts, the governor.
And did you, Marty, win over some of the critics in Lawrence?
Yes, because they have seen the progress in Lawrence Public Schools, and the receiver was so thoughtful in how he engaged with the community. He didn't exercise all of the powers that he had because he understood the rebellion that would occur when he left. Things would just go back to the old ways. So graduation rates have gone up a substantial amount. So from they were 47% of kids graduated in 2010, so less than half of all students were graduating. And right now, 72% of all students graduate in 4 years. So more room for improvement. 72% is not enough, but an extraordinary change from fewer than half of the students graduating. Test scores are up. Almost on every measure, the schools are improving academically. And the one thing that's important to keep in mind is that this did not come from wholesale firing of teachers or blaming the educators. You know, in the first year of receivership, very few teachers lost their jobs. This isn't about blaming anyone. It is creating a new environment in which teachers can thrive. And again, not a huge infusion of money either. What the receiver did in Lawrence was take a lot of central administration staff and redeploy those funds into schools. So shifting the budget and putting resources into school buildings away from central administration. So this doesn't require a big infusion of cash either. Some communities may need that. But there are strategies that can be adopted that lead to incredible outcomes for kids. And that's where the focus can go. That's where it was in Lawrence. And the community has really rallied around the improvements in their schools.
All right, Chris, what do you say to those who think maybe your appointment in Newark was anti-democratic?
Well, first of all, when I became the superintendent of schools in Newark, I did so with a commitment from the governor that I would spend the next 3 years restoring democratic local control. And we worked very, very hard. And I echo everything that Marty just said. The goal here is to make sure that the community is engaged, that democratic leadership is engaged, the mayor, the school board, and so on, such that they become more effective leaders of the school system once it's returned to their hands. And that is a very complicated, very intentional process. But I want to go back directly to your question. It is extremely important in this world to ask yourself, as every person in this community and any community should do, what is our central objective? And I will tell you, and I share Marty's view about this, there is a moral imperative in this country. I taught history for 4 years. It's sort of built into our founding documents. That equality of opportunity, that every child should have a fair chance to blossom to his or her fullest potential. And public education is intended to be the catalytic force. That means that you need not be who your parents were, or you need not have a destiny determined by your birth circumstances. It is not that local control or democracy are not values in their own right, but sometimes, and I think this may have been implicit in Marty's comments, those two circles on a Venn diagram do not fully overlap. Sometimes ceding to the value of local control and democracy may not be in the best interest of children. I can tell you it absolutely was not in Newark in 1995, and what has happened in Lawrence is a really phenomenal success, and I'm sure the same was true as well. So sometimes you have to honor all the values that are implicated in this huge $750 billion a year enterprise called American Public Education. But when you have to choose between addressing the fact that if you are born in the bottom decile of socioeconomic status in this country, the probability that you will graduate from high school and be fully prepared for a successful venture in college or career is diminishingly low. Correcting that moral injustice has to be our central focus, and it has to, and everything else has to be subordinate to that.
Well, and this is the second common critique, which is that that even if receivership, even if some kind of intervention model has worked in some places, we have seen all kinds of reforms and interventions in primarily impoverished districts, usually in urban settings, and that the real challenge here is poverty. That without a massive shift in poverty, frankly, in segregation, and I mean by and socioeconomic lines in this country, you can try anything you want, and you may have some outlier successes, but for the most part, poverty is at the core of the problem, and that we should all set about fixing that here. What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, first of all, it is absolutely true that the single greatest determinant of educational outcomes is the socioeconomic status of the student. There's no denying that reality. There's also no denying the reality that poverty is not destiny. There are plenty of individuals, plenty of schools, and plenty of districts that actually find a way to launch children successfully into adulthood. School matters. It's not a denial of poverty. It's not of the relevance of poverty. It is an acknowledgement that what happened in Lawrence, what is happening in Lawrence, what happened in Newark, what is happening in Newark, we gave thousands of children an opportunity at life that they would otherwise not have had. Did we fix poverty? No. Did we take into account poverty in some of the policies we implemented? Absolutely. But to simply say that if you're dealing with poverty, nothing works and school doesn't matter, until you fix poverty, you won't fix schools, in my judgment, is defeatist and not supported by the facts.
Okay. Marty?
An important point is that schools on an individual level have proven Chris's point. The challenge I think you're getting at with the question is, can you do it at scale? Can you do it in an entire community, in an entire school district? Because there's always the one-off success stories of individual schools. What we're talking about with Newark and with Lawrence and other communities is to say, yes, in spite of poverty, you can do this at scale. Often it takes the longer school day because you need more time to overcome the effects of poverty. But you can do this at scale. It's not a one model works in every community. But what we do know is that you can do it beyond one school building at a time. If we wait for us to solve poverty in this country and have no one living in poverty, we will never get to the point of being able to give the children the education we know they need, they deserve, and that they're capable of great things. If you put them in a classroom with a great teacher, we know what works, but as adults, we are choosing not to do it. And I think that's the sense of urgency you're hearing now in Rochester, is we know we can do this if we have the political courage to do it and the will as adults to do it for the kids in the city.
Chris, when you were appointed in 2015 in Newark, you came in and, you know, 3 years later, the Star Ledger says, well, you closed the worst schools and you fired the worst principals. That sounds easy. Somebody just gave you a list and said, here are the worst. Just go get rid of these and things will be fine. You got to make some determinations. And this is very subjective, and it can be very emotional whenever you're talking about closing schools, whenever you're debating about what makes a principal or a teacher or anything else good or bad or effective or ineffective. What was your method? How did you go about this?
Well, first of all, the goal is to have as many excellent school options for parents to choose from as possible. Closure is a last resort. Many of the schools that we closed, you know, suggest an image of a padlock on the door of an old school building. Many of them were converted or restarted or the like. But something else I will tell you, and I'd be very interested in Marty's perspective. I mean, I love peace and harmony and consensus, and I work very, very hard to generate as much community support for the work. But I will also tell you, somewhat controversially, Evan, that peace and harmony and consensus is not the point of this work. The point of this work is to get children a fair chance at life, regardless of their circumstances, into which, through no decision of their own, they find themselves. And sometimes doing hard things causes controversy. And I will tell you that the only thing we know for sure in Rochester, and I, by the way, want to echo Marty's point, that there is not a bad intention to be found here. There's no blame. And good-willing, good-hearted people are doing their level best. But the only thing we can say with absolute certainty is if we continue to do the same things that we've been doing for the last 20, 30 years here, there will not be change. The other thing you can say is that change is controversial. And sometimes, to be a little bit blunt about it, has casualties. And if you don't have a system of governance, and let me be very clear about this, there is no governance solution that has not failed, whether it's a receivership or a state takeover or anything else. It's not the name you put to it. It is how it is done. But I will tell you that unless there is a transformational change around how things are done, unless there's a willingness to tolerate some of the blowback from change that will improve the lives of children, you'll essentially default to the least common denominator, and that's not working for many, many kids.
What was your approach to, as you say, understanding that some people are going to be offended, even well-intended people, or harmony isn't always going to happen, but at the same time, there was, as the Star Ledger reported, that toxic relationship between local and state, and it seems to have improved, at least from the reporting that I've read, through your tenure. How did you do that?
I spent virtually every evening in the community. And when I say in the community, I don't mean just at large public meetings, which I did my share of. They were at over coffee in kitchens and churches, trying to explain what we were doing and trying to encourage participation and a sort of shared set of values. And it was not always successful, but one of the things I've learned, and obviously Marty has a lot of experience in elected office, as do others, one of the things you learn is it's very hard to hate up close. And the more you're out there and people see what your intentions are and what you're trying to do, I think the harder it is to sort of default to the sort of vitriol and rhetoric that sometimes characterizes public debate.
And before I turn back to Marty, I'm going to kind of work through some of the essays she wrote for the Democrat and Chronicle recently. Before I do that, she referenced, you know, and I think as you have, Chris, the idea that sometimes the status quo does not put kids first. It feels like it puts administrators first or central office. That's sort of an old saw. But do you feel that way? Do you feel like there is administrative bulk and that the emphasis is there instead of on the students, or is that a kind of a cliche?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. Here's what I would say. As I mentioned before, the public education sector is second only to healthcare in terms of its economic magnitude. It's about $750 billion a year. It is not at all surprising that that attracts a lot of interests, most of which are entirely legitimate and valuable. The interest in democratic control, for example, the interest in employees as employees and the avoidance of arbitrary employment decisions, for example, fairness and so on. These are all important things. Sometimes they absolutely overlap with the best interest of children. For example, I think paying teachers more serves teachers and it serves children because it attracts better people and keeps them in the profession longer. But sometimes it doesn't. For example, I don't see any defense for a strategy that says that communities of teachers and principals can't choose who shares their values and culture to come and teach at the school. We shouldn't be assigning teachers to schools when they're not a good fit. So that is a rule.
Is that your way of saying we should be able to fire teachers?
No, it's not. My rule is we should have a system based on mutual consent. That is, a teacher should work at a school if the principal and often with a committee of his or her faculty.
But does that mean reforming tenure?
Not necessarily, no. I do actually think, as we did in New Jersey, tenure reform is important. No, all I'm saying is if you are holding a school accountable for improving math or reading scores, for example, then you say you don't get to pick the teachers in the classrooms. We're going to assign them to you, whether or not they're a good fit. I just put this out as an example. There's a reason to do that, a reason to avoid arbitrariness, a reason to protect seniority. All of these are valuable things, but it's hard to defend them as in the best interests of children. So I don't think that I would say, as you say, it's kind of a cliche, this is all about the adults. No, I think that there are sometimes competing values to choose between, and I have made a career of choosing the children first.
And when it comes to paying teachers more, all teachers, some teachers, merit-based, is there a system for that? What did you do?
Well, there's a lot of writing about that. What we did in Newark, and we got a lot of press, I actually negotiated this with Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers. We got rid of the steps and lanes. Under a traditional system, you have a different lane for PhDs, for MAs, for BAs, and every year you have an automatic step raise. We basically got rid of all the lanes and said, no, we're going to pre-negotiate the raises you get, but you only get a raise if you've been found to be an effective teacher. And overwhelmingly, teachers did were found to be effective. So it wasn't merit pay. That would be a mischaracterization. I do deeply believe that it devalues teachers to treat them as interchangeable commodities. There is a natural distribution of efficacy in any profession, in radio hosts and superintendents and architects and lawyers. Most people are in the broad middle. Most people are very good at what they do, but there are outliers on either end. They're extraordinary, outstanding performers, and some people who are underperforming. And a system of compensation that does not honor that reality seems to be unfair to children.
And what do you think the average teacher in the Newark district would say about that system today?
Well, we actually know the answer to that. We did a lot of different surveys. AIR, which is an independent research group, found that the teachers overwhelmingly supported it.
All right. So in our second half hour, we're going to talk to Marty Walls about some of her thoughts about not only what you just heard from Chris, but also some of the ideas that she posted in an essay with the Democrat and Chronicle recently about what Rochester can learn from Lawrence, Massachusetts, and their experience with receivership and the efforts to improve schools. Four steps there. So we'll talk to Marty about that. And she's on the line with us. Marty Walls, a Rochester native and an attorney, a former Massachusetts legislator, and someone with a lot of experience in crafting what school receivership looks like in that state. Kent Gardner's here, an economist and an opinion editor for the Rochester Beacon, who have put together this event this afternoon that includes Chris Cerf, who is former commissioner of education for the state of New Jersey, former deputy chancellor of New York City Public Schools, and a former superintendent appointed to lead the Newark School District. Kent and the Rochester Beacon putting together this event to talk about the so-called elephant in the room, about education in Rochester. Mayor Warren will be there this afternoon, along with Jackie Campbell from Rock the Future, Adam Urbanski from the Rochester Teachers Association, and parent leaders and more. Unfortunately, for our listeners, that event is overbooked, and they have no more room. You can understand why there's so much interest in that. But if you want to join the program and share your thoughts, you can email connections at wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. And I will just put one other fine point on this, because I know there are so many strong opinions on schools, rightfully so. And in the last week, Rochester has had its share of headlines about emotion at school board meetings, emotion among different candidates. And we seek to have productive conversations among candidates. You're going to hear all the candidates for school board on this program between now and voting day in June next month. And we are certainly going to be talking about different solutions and hear from a lot of different stakeholders. This is just a chance to hear from a couple of people who have done this way in other cities and states. So let's get that break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Richard Sheridan joins us first hour. He's coming to Rochester. He's the author of the book Chief Joy Officer: How Great Leaders Elevate Human Energy and Eliminate Fear. He'll tell us his views on how to do it. In our second hour, a conversation about, well, you might have heard about shortages in the construction trades, how to get more people in the trades. We'll talk about it Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. So when Marty Walls wrote an essay for the Democrat and Chronicle, she drew on her experience in Massachusetts, and in particular, we've been talking about the work in the Lawrence Public School District. We should clarify, Marty, just what kind of size Lawrence is, where it's located in Massachusetts. People like to sort of compare as best they can to their own districts. So tell us a little bit about Lawrence.
Lawrence is an old urban community up on the New Hampshire border. The school district is about half the size of Rochester in terms of the number of students. The demographics, though, are remarkably similar in many respects, including predominantly kids of color and low income, with a large number of English language learners. So if you drive north of Boston, you're going to get to Lawrence right before you get to the New Hampshire border.
In your essay for the Democrat and Chronicle, you have four steps, and I kind of want to work through them quickly here. And you start with this. First, lay out a clear, bold strategy for improvement and stick to it. You write, Rochester needs a great leader who is given time and power to implement a bold vision. And I think this goes to the idea that a lot of reforms are tried, especially in education. And 12 months in, 18 months in, people say, it's not working, and you kind of scrap it. You are advocating very clearly to make sure whoever is given that power is also given time. How much time?
Well, Lawrence has been under receivership since 2011, and we're now in 2019. They've made great strides, but we are looking at something that could easily take 10 years. This is long, hard, slow work. Anyone who thinks someone's going to come into Rochester and in a year, suddenly, magically, it's all going to be done, is setting someone up for failure. This is going to take a long time. It's taken a long time to get the schools here, and it's going to take a long time to put them in a place where everyone's going to be proud to be able to send their children to a Rochester school. And that's where, whether it's under receivership or the new superintendent or some other model, this is going to take time, and it's going to take political courage because, as Chris said earlier, change is controversial. This is going to be controversial. I think everyone needs to come into this understanding that and recognize that they're going to have to wade through that controversy and not give up and not give into it, but move through it with the community so that we get on the other side and the schools are improved. But this is not easy or quick work.
You say second, empower great school leaders, and you talk about how Lawrence replaced roughly half of the principals in schools, but the principals who are currently in the system, you say, may make for great leaders who also need autonomy to implement a bold turnaround plan. So what does it look like in Rochester, for example, if the district is going to empower great school leaders?
If the principals who are there today are the ones who are the right ones to implement a bold plan, no reason for them to change. But if they are not the right people who are on board with the changes that are needed, it may be time for them to step aside. I think that's really one of the keys, is who's the right leader in each building to implement the change that's needed in that particular school. Different schools need different kinds of leaders, but Chris was making the point earlier about mutual consent hiring. Often that's done in a collective bargaining agreement, but the idea is you need the right leader in each building with a team of educators who wants to go in the same direction that that principal wants to go in. Then you've got a unified team in the school, and that's where they need the autonomy. Principals need the ability to pick their team. Imagine being the head of an organization and you have no control over who your employees are. You're not going to be able to implement a vision without having employees who want to go in the same direction you want to go in.
I'm going to take a phone call next because I think then the caller's question goes to points 3 and 4 on your recommendations. Bernard in Fairport on the line. Go ahead, Bernard.
Hi. I guess my question is, what can you do to get the parents working better with education? Because it seems to me that, in my mind anyway, the parent is the primary teacher of the children, and the teachers at schools are kind of secondary. And is there enough access to the parents of these children? And do you guys interact with them and so forth? Is that important? I may be wrong and so on and so forth, and I apologize, but I'm interested. Thanks very much.
That's a great question, Bernard. So points 3 and 4, which I'll read, and then I'm going to let Marty kind of explain how she views these points and how they may relate to Bernard's question. She writes, embrace collaboration and get the community's buy-in, including nonprofit groups as community partners, prioritizing teachers visiting families at home, and more. So go ahead, Marty.
I think the question's exactly right. Parents are their children's first teacher and are incredibly important to the success of the schools. So it is that collaboration that is essential. And I suspect Chris is going to say the same thing happened in Newark, which is that the parents were important players in all of this. Schools cannot do it alone. Parents can't do it alone. They have to be working together. And that's one of the lessons coming out of Lawrence, is that parents played an important role. And they are the ones, too, who will continue to advocate for the changes that are happening so that when receivership ends, the practices that have led to academic success for their kids continue on and don't get abandoned. And the parents are the stakeholders, and they're the ones who are going to fight to keep the changes in place.
Yeah, Chris, you want to take that, too?
Sure. So there's two critical ways that parents can be engaged that makes a huge difference for children. One is in the political arena, that is to be active and activists in demanding change and holding, frankly, public officials accountable for success. That's what most people talk about when they talk about parental engagement. But Marty's exactly right. The single greatest way that a parent can support the successful education of his or her child or a family member can is honestly to have high expectations for that child, to set rules to read to that child or with that child every night, to do math problems with that child every night, to make sure that there is very high visibility around that child's progress and failure in a loving way that honors the child. But honestly, if parents found the time to really, really participate in the education of their child beyond the usual parental relationship and parental duties, that can, and research shows, will make a very substantial difference.
But Marty, I want to go back to that third point. When you say embrace collaboration, that may feel a little dissonant to listeners who have been hearing our guests talk this hour about the importance of empowering a receiver and giving that person time and power, the authority to make changes, even if people don't like it. Can you make that advocacy while also saying we got to embrace collaboration?
Really strong leaders are not just dictators. They bring the community along with them. And that's about collaborating with others. And a receiver may not have all of the best ideas. There's a lot of good ideas out there. Each community, each neighborhood is going to have ideas for a particular school. These are not mutually exclusive ideas. You need someone ultimately to have the power to make the decisions, for sure. But that person has to be able to listen, be out in the community, to be adaptable, and make sure that the changes in the community that are required to be made are getting made, not because a receiver is commanding them to be made, but the community is being empowered to make them. For example, the question about parents. We need parents involved with the schools, but the schools have to make space for the parents to be involved. This is a two-way street. So parents can't just knock on the door and be told, no, you're not welcome. Everyone needs to be engaged. Someone's going to be in charge for sure. But let's get all of the people to the table and make the changes that are necessary so these schools aren't just one-off or that we revert back to old ways because the community's not invested in the change.
All right. Well, do you agree with that as well, Chris? Can there be that balance? I mean, if a community is going to understand the power of a receiver to make these sometimes difficult decisions, knowing that there's going to be controversy. I mean, Marty has emphasized that as well this hour. You have to accept that you're not going to please right. everybody. How do you balance that with actual collaboration?
It's a very, very tough line to walk. But it sort of starts with this. I believe deeply in the dignity of giving every parent, every stakeholder voice to make sure that she or he is heard, that he or she has the opportunity to weigh in on what's best for his or her child. Now, giving someone the opportunity to be heard is not the same as agreeing with them. And that is a point that sometimes gets lost in the realm of politics. But you have to start by giving everybody an opportunity to participate. And again, as Marty says, and I really agree with this, an effective leader is a very secure person who knows that she or he sometimes starts in a place that needs to be refined or even abandoned on the basis of the input of others. And you have to be secure enough to go, you know what, I just learned something from this conversation. We would have school board meetings that would go 5, 6, 7 hours into the night, where there was sort of open mic night at the end of it, where everybody got 3 minutes to talk. And sometimes you would just go, oh my, you know, here we go again with this point or that point. But if you listened really carefully, often I would find that there was a really important thing being said. Maybe not the way I would have preferred to it be said, but it being said. And we would go back and we would go meet with the person and hear the concern and do something about it whenever we thought it had merit. People notice that and people pay attention to that, although you don't bat a thousand ever.
All right. So a couple of listener comments, if we could here. Let me pull up an email from Adam who says, Evan, appreciate this conversation. My issue with mayoral control is this is not about Rochester's mayor. Most elected mayors are not professional educators, and I wouldn't want to trust education in their hands. But someone who has been a superintendent or a principal or at least a teacher, perhaps. What do your guests think about mayoral control? I'll start with Chris.
Well, I worked for Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, and he, of course, is not an educator, but he did more for the children of New York than any other individual I can think of in terms of advancing educational interest. Good leaders attract thoughtful, smart people and rely on them and help them, support them, do great things. Mayoral control is the exception across the country. There are really only a handful of districts that have it, or relatively few. It has worked in some places. It has not worked in some places. My general bias is in favor of mayoral control when you have a dysfunctional school system for several reasons. Everybody votes for mayor. A lot of people vote for mayor. In Rochester, for example, something like 3% of the population here voted for school board members and principally through the primary process. Mayors are much more directly accountable to the people than school boards. School boards are often subject to interest group capture. When you have very, very few votes can swing an election, it's very easy through a phone bank or through other forms of generating interest to capture a seat. I think that's much harder to do for a mayor. And lastly, you know, this is there's no priority in terms of serving democratic values between a mayor and by the way, another point that Marty made along the way that I think is worth saying, even a receiver, you haven't ceded democratic accountability. In the end, that person owes his or her job to, in Massachusetts' case, the governor or the commissioner, who is an elected official.
Yeah, but if we're just measuring democratic accountability, being appointed by a governor, most people in the state don't live in Lawrence. They're not all that interested and aren't going to vote on that. Whereas if there is mayoral control in Rochester, everyone is interested in Rochester and the performance of a city school district. And I am not sitting here making a case for or against. I'm just observing. Marty, is that fair? Or do you think, how do you feel about mayoral control vis-a-vis a receiver appointed by a governor?
I think we're comparing apples and oranges. Mayoral control comes in so many different types. How much control does the mayor actually have is the most important question. Same with receiver. How much control does the receiver have? In the end, it's not as much about the form of governance as it is ultimately about who has the autonomy and the power to make the changes that are necessary. In some communities, it might be the mayor. In other places, it might be a receiver. So I'd hesitate to make any kind of generalizations that mayoral control is the answer or receivership is the answer. Receivership is likely the better answer, in my view, in Rochester under the current circumstances, given the extraordinary level of dysfunction and poor performance in the schools. It is going to take a fairly radical overhaul to get Rochester to where it needs to go over an extended period of time. And you don't want to have different mayors over time. If this is going to take 10 or 15 years, unless Mayor Warren's going to be around for a very long time, the risk of mayoral control is that you get different mayors over time that can destabilize the long and hard work that's necessary in the schools.
Okay, Chris?
So I want to, again, echo the point. It's not the form of governance that is the answer. It is the powers that whoever is in charge has. There are all sorts of limitations on the ability of anybody, any group right now, to do what needs to be done. And they are embedded in overregulation at the state level. They are embedded in elements of the collective bargaining agreement. And you don't need to pick on anybody to go, if you're going to do what needs to be done here, you have to be empowered to clear away some of that detritus and do things that need to be done. I fundamentally agree that this is a 7 to 10 year enterprise, and continuity of leadership is an essential feature of this. And if that can be done through a mayor, great. But I do tend in the direction that Marty took us to, and that is that there's a higher probability of continuity through the other model.
Kent Gardner, as we get ready to wrap the program, I appreciate what our guests have brought in terms of getting a chance to understand their experience and perspective. Do you think Rochester is in position to have a productive enough conversation to make a decision either way? I mean, I don't know, as the opinion editor of The Beacon, if you come out on any one particular side, but are you feeling like the discourse is productive or sort of toxic right now?
I think the discourse has gotten to the point where we have said as a community we need to do something really radically different. And so I think there is an openness to something like a receiver model. I think it's an openness to mayoral control as well. So I'm not certainly going to take a position here, but I do think there's an openness to doing something significantly different. And the second half of our forum this afternoon focuses on school-by-school changes. We're looking at the receivership model as it's been implemented at East High. We're looking at community schools as implemented at School 17. We're looking at charter schools. These are different models that can be applied to the Rochester schools, too. We could expand some of these. We could do more with charter schools. We could do more with charter conversions. We could move more in the community school direction. So.
All right, 30 seconds, Marty. The biggest impediment to fixing struggling schools is what?
I think in New York State, what we need is a change in state law that's going to empower people in Rochester to make the dramatic change that's needed. That's going to take a lot of political courage, but I think courage is what's needed, and if the delegation in the state legislature that represents Rochester steps forward, perhaps there can be a solution that's tailored to meet Rochester's needs.
Okay, Chris?
I think the biggest impediment to change is that as much as people say that we will make every sacrifice possible in order to best serve the interests of impoverished children, when it comes down to choosing between that value and the preservation of control and ownership and other interests that are implicated on it, the best interests of children very, very typically get subordinated to those. Until people understand the inertial forces of the current political system and have a plan to overcome that, I don't think we'll see much in the way of change.
Chris was the former superintendent at Newark, the former commissioner of education for the state of New Jersey, former deputy chancellor of New York City Public Schools. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Appreciate that.
My great pleasure.
Our thanks to Marty Walls, a Rochester native and a former legislator in Massachusetts, an attorney with plenty of experience in crafting school receivership programming in Massachusetts. Thank you, Marty. Appreciate the conversation this hour.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
And Kent Gardner, opinion editor for the Rochester Beacon, which is hosting that event, which is, I'd say, sold out. It's booked out this afternoon. But I appreciate you putting this together for us and wish you well with that. Thank you, Kent.
Thank you, Evan.
All right. Our thanks to Megan Mack, the producer and the engineer. Wow. And Gary Putup doing what Gary does. I'm Evan. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.